Hello, my name's Dan Kalinski. I'm a QC at Landmark Chambers. One of my main areas of practice is non-domestic rates, sometimes described as business rates. This is an area that some people find inaccessible, but when they dig into it, they often remark that it's of surprising interest. One of the areas that I think is of interest is the fact that in resolving statutory questions today, it's often relevant to dig back into the history. And so, for example, in a case that I was fortunate enough to be involved in, known as Woolway or Mazars, which dealt with the approach to one of the central concepts in the rating legislation of hereditament, it was necessary in preparing that to dig back into the legislative history. And an understanding of that history proved to be decisive to the determination of some of the issues in that case. And so my experience suggests that it is worth, at the very least, having an understanding of the history in broad terms in order to understand how to approach issues in the modern legislation and whether it's worth looking back at what's happened in the past. Now, I'm not alone in that belief, and I'm going to start with some observations from Lord Justice Robert Walker in a case called Williams and Scottish and Newcastle from 2001, where he observed that the law of rating is statutory and ancient, going back even before the Poor Relief Act of 1601. Apart from comparatively recent upheavals in the form of community charge and council tax in relation to residential property, the body of statute law has shown extraordinary stability. This slow and steady process of evolution means that there is a large volume of case law, some of it quite old, which is still relevant to the understanding of the principles underlying the modern law. However, he warned that what he described as respect for intellectual freight from earlier centuries must not be carried too far. And the example he gave was that you can't fasten upon pronouncements by judges, however eminent, without regard to the context in which they were made. So there was a bit of a health warning there about necessarily assuming that dicta from Victorian cases about railways, docks and waterworks would provide the answer to modern day problems. That said, it's clear that one does need to think about and understand the history, at least in some cases. So I start in 1601, the Poor Relief Act, also known as the Statute of Elizabeth. Now, this was effectively the foundation point of rating as a taxation on occupation. So the Act said that there would be liability for poor rates in the following terms: to raise weekly or otherwise by taxation of every inhabitant, parson, vicar and other, and of every occupier of lands, houses, and then it went on, competent sums for the necessary relief of the poor. So there's a couple of concepts that are at least implicit and to an extent explicit in that 1601 statutory foundation. The two I'm going to highlight are that it is a tax on the occupation of land, and secondly, this idea of the raising of competent sums of money. And that is the foundation stone of what's sometimes called the principle of equality, which is that every ratepayer should pay their equal share on an objective mechanism, and that's what has become the statutory hypothesis, which is now contained in Schedule 6 to the Local Government Finance Act of 1988. But at least to some extent, you can trace back the origins of that basic concept all the way back to the 1601 Poor Relief Act. So I'm going to jump forward, you'll be relieved to hear, a couple of centuries. And the next act I'm just going to mention is called the Parochial Assessment Act of 1836. And there are two reasons for mentioning this. The first one is that it is the first universal act that refers to the concept of hereditament, which, as we'll come on to see, is the unit of property to be shown in the rating list. Now, it wasn't defined in quite those terms in this act, but there was a reference to hereditaments. The concept of a hereditament was already one at that time that was a workable concept, because it had been referred to already in local rating provisions. And so, for example, in an 1832 case of the Crown and Shrewsbury Paving Trustees, there's reference to hereditament in local rating provisions. But it's the first time that this is set out in a universal statute as a concept to which rates attach. And the second reason why the Parochial Assessment Act of 1836 is of some relevance is that there was a statutory basis for the first time to the determination of what was known as the net annual value. And that's really the predecessor of the rateable value, which is nowadays determined according to Schedule 6 of the 1988 Act. So that's the Parochial Assessment Act of 1836. There then is a sort of stage in the 19th century where there were some steps towards the modern law of rating. So there was, for example, in 1840, the abolition of taxation in respect of personal property, that thereby leaving the residue of being a tax on the occupation of land, which is what the modern law of non-domestic rates resembles. In 1862, there was the creation of committees the provision of the making of valuation lists and the ability of people to object to those. That was in the Union Assessment Act of 1862. Now, that wasn't universal at that stage, but that's an important step towards the establishment of local committees at that stage for the challenge and determination of rateable values. In the Valuation Metropolis Act of 1869, there was a requirement for the preparation of valuation lists. At that stage, that was only to the metropolis outside of London. That was ultimately applied to London in the Rating and Valuation Act of 1925 that I'm going to come on to shortly. The next provisions that are just worth mentioning are the Agricultural Rates Act of 1896, which provided a differential rate in relation to agricultural land, and that's built into some of the exemptions that still feature today. In 1899, rates were consolidated in London into a single rate. And then we get to the 1925 Act, and the 1925 Act was a piece of national legislation, a really important reform of non-domestic rates, and it sought to consolidate various rates and promote uniformity in the valuation of property for the purpose of rates. And that's a critical concept today. As I've already explained, I consider that you can trace that back all the way to 1601, but it was there in 1925 as a express purpose on the face of the legislation. And there was the concept of valuation lists with particulars in respect of every hereditament in the area and the prescribed value to be stated on there. Now, importantly, on these valuation lists was to be shown every hereditament that is or may become the subject of a rate. And the purpose of that or may be to become is something that is interesting, and as I understand it, based on the discussion in the leading textbook of Ride at the time, it was understood to be a mechanism by which, because of course you have to bear in mind at this stage rates is only levied on occupied property, so at the point at which property is complete and ready and capable of beneficial occupation, it can be inserted into the rating list so that when it is occupied, the rate can be levied. I should also add, by way of a footnote, that the 1925 Act is really important for being the foundation stone of the codification of plant, which is to be included in the valuation. So plant and machinery that counts or does not count for the purpose of determining the rateable value. And the history of that was discussed in a case called Iceland in the Supreme Court, where again they went right back to the history in determining where the division line is between plant that counts for the purpose of valuation and plant that doesn't. The court looked very closely in Iceland at the history of the legislation and also a document called the Short Report, which had led to the made some recommendations which led to the 1925 Act's approach to the division of non-rateable plant and rateable plant. So I'm then going to fast forward to the Local Government Act of 1948, and this is important because it separated out the function of assessing rateable value and maintaining the rating list, which was to be undertaken by the Inland Revenue, and the collection of rates, which was undertaken by local authorities. Now, that understanding that division between the maintenance of the rating list, the determination of the rateable value on the one hand, which is a centralised function, and the collection and enforcement of rates, which is undertaken by local authorities, is absolutely critical to the practical functioning of the rating system today. Next stop is the Local Government Act of 1966. Now, 1966 was a momentous year for non-domestic rates as well as English football, because what happened for the first time was that there was the ability within a statutory machinery in the Local Government Act of 1966 to create the potential to rate unoccupied property. Now, this is a fundamental transformation from what had happened for the past 350 years, where only occupied property was to be rated. Suddenly there was the ability, if the local authority went through a mechanism for resolving to do it, to rate land which was unoccupied as if the hereditament were occupied during that period. And the burden fell on the owner rather than the occupier of land. We then reached the General Rate Act of 1967. Now, this is critical to an understanding of modern rates, because the 1967 Act was in short a masterpiece of consolidation. It was a consolidating act to bring together certain enactments relating to rating and valuation in England and Wales. And Ryde, in its 1976 edition, said it consolidates practically the whole of statute law on rating in force at the date it was enacted, bringing into a single statute more than 30 statutes from the Poor Relief Act of 1601 to the Local Government Act of 1966. It's important to recognise that this was a masterpiece of legislation. It brought together all of that history into a single comprehensive statutory scheme for non-domestic rates. It's worth taking a moment just to get inside the mind of Parliamentary Counsel, who was responsible for drawing all of this together. And I'm going to quote from his statement to the Parliamentary Committee in relation to what was then Clause 16, became Section 16, which is dealing with liability for occupied rates. So the central provision within the legislation. And he commented as follows: as nearly always happens when you are looking at a branch of law which has existed for a long time, the law tends to have proceeded from point A to point B around five sides of a hexagon, blowing up the bridges behind it. When you come to consolidate, the ruins will no longer be there to pick your way through. The only way to consolidate is to build another bridge direct from point A to point B along the sixth side of the hexagon. And that is what the last five lines of Clause 16 attempt to do. One has to build a bridge from the provisions of the Poor Relief Act, which is still the foundation stone on which liability of the occupier for rating is built, which provided that the overseers of the poor should take orders from time to time to raise by taxation of every occupier of lands, houses and coal mines competent sums of money for the necessary relief of the poor. One has got to build a bridge somehow from that to a modern system of rating of individual hereditaments according to their value in the valuation list. Now, the way Parliamentary Council constructed that new bridge was through the definition of hereditaments, because in section 115 of the 1967 Act, the provision was as follows. Hereditament means property which is or may become liable to a rate, being a unit of such property which is or would fall to be shown as a separate item in the valuation list. Now, this was Parliamentary Counsel's attempt to provide perhaps a bit more colour on what he regarded as the unilluminating and unhelpful definition of hereditament in Section 68 of the 1925 Act. And he explained this, that when one looks at the context in which the expression, that is, hereditament, is used, what it clearly means is the particular slice of rateable property which is or would appear as a separate item in the valuation list. Now, a lot of ink has been spilt and a lot of thinking time has been expended discussing what that means, a unit of property. So, for example, in the 2015 case of Mazars, we were thinking about whether two floors of property which were not next to each other in a multi-office building but were occupied by the same firm of accountants would be a unit of property. Supreme Court held that they wouldn't. Also observed that it wouldn't make a difference if those floors were adjoining. That still wouldn't be a unit. And that led to a piece of legislation to reverse that decision in response to the tabloids getting hold of and agitated by the concept of what it deemed the staircase tax. It seems to me that much of the interest that has surfaced in recent times is referable to a central tension within the machinery of the 1967 Act, because in order to determine what is a hereditament, you need to understand the unit of occupation of property. But in order to determine who is the rateable occupier, you need to understand which area you are focusing on, because that will make a central difference to the application of the case law on rateable occupation. Now, that tension is most acute in a case concerning the rateability of ATM sites, and that was a matter that was debated in the Supreme Court earlier this month over 2 days. I was fortunate enough to take part in that along with a number of colleagues from Landmark Chambers, and we look forward with great interest to what the decision of the Supreme Court will be in relation to the interface between the identification of the hereditament and the application of the case law on rateable occupation, which may make a really important difference in that case. It's worth, I think, highlighting the observations of Lord Justice Sedley coming to this perhaps as an outsider in a case called Vitesse, because he observed the key to the apparently circular definition given in section 115(1) of the General Rate Act of 1967, which defines a hereditament by its liability to rating, is that it assumes and relies on an existing fund of knowledge of what is and is not capable of being shown as a separate item in the valuation rating list. So his insight really is that in order to actually make sense of this statutory framework, you need to understand this whole body fund of knowledge and this case law, which has worked up in previous years. Quite a bit of time on the 1967 Act, because as I say, it was something of a masterpiece, drawing together 350 years plus of legislation and trying to bring it together in a comprehensive scheme. Now, it's of limited relevance to the present day for reasons that I will explain, because in the 1988 Local Government Finance Act, which is the relevant statutory framework for rates today, the whole of the 1967 Act was repealed with effect from the 1st of April 1990. And there were major changes brought about by that legislation, including the abolition of rating in respect of domestic property, the introduction of the poll charge, the poll tax, which of course led to riots in the streets, and the abolition of the local authority's role in setting the rate applicable to non-domestic property and replacing it with uniform business rates, which were determined by the Secretary of State. So rating becomes something of a casualty of the Thatcherite government's attempts to take power away from local authorities. But what it did in the context of rating law is it took away a detailed and carefully crafted statutory framework, and it replaced it with a pretty threadbare statutory provision which gave over much power to the Secretary of State to create regulations and to prescribe conditions, but with a real bare bones statutory framework. So we need to understand that Section 43 is the foundation stone of liability for occupied rates, and that depends on there being a prescribed hereditament shown in a centralised rating list. Section 45, similarly, is the foundation stone for liability for unoccupied rates, and again requires a prescribed hereditament, but the detail of what is a prescribed hereditament is to be found in the secondary legislation. As well as being threadbare and hardly fit for purpose, the Local Government Finance Act of 1988 was also not really self-contained, because Section 64 of that Act provides that a hereditament is anything which, by virtue of the definition in Section 1151 of the 1967 Act, would have been hereditament for the purpose of the Act had this Act not been passed. Now, Sir Alan Ward, in his penultimate judgment in a case called Reeves in the Court of Appeal, summed up this provision as legislative gobbledygook. Now, legislative gobbledygook or otherwise, it seems to me that what the Section 64 of the 1988 Act does is it makes it absolutely critical to be able to understand the pre-existing body of case law in the way that Lord Justice Sedley observed. So my overall summary of the 1988 Act is that it is a barely adequate legislative framework that doesn't create a clean break from the 1967 Act, because the central definition of hereditament borrows from the existing fund of case law that existed up to the consolidation in 1967. So that has continuing relevance, but it lacks any of the comprehensiveness or clarity of the 1967 Act, and it gives over much of the hard work and heavy lifting to statutory instruments, which may or may not be particularly instructive in any given case. And so the tension that you face as a lawyer is you've got a new statutory framework that is the beginning and end of the provisions that you need to construe. But in order to make workable sense of them, you often have to go back over the 350 years of history to see how things were done, and then to try to work out whether there is a conscious change that has taken place in 1988, or whether the natural words used call for a different approach. So it's very often critical to understand what the position was before the 1988 Act in order to make an intelligent assessment of whether that has changed and whether there's a coherent proposition that there is a different approach deliberately conferred by the threadbare words used in the 1988 legislation. And I think much of the interest in rating is in trying to make sense of this wholly inadequate framework in 1988, knowing that 21 years earlier there was this masterpiece put together which codified 350 years of history into a thoroughly thought through framework, which was then abandoned in a period of political turmoil when the eyes of the legislators were on other things like how you tax domestic property. And business rates are now left with this framework that is scarcely fit for purpose, but which those participating in the system have to make work as best they can, which often involves going back and looking how things were understood when there was a more coherent framework of law that was emerging, and where there was an attempt to piece that all together in 1967. So I do need to just go forward from the 1988 Act to just highlight a couple of points that are of critical importance. So the 2007 Rating Empty Property Act is important because this has led to the 2008 regulations, which have a much more aggressive approach to the taxation of unoccupied rates. And again, unoccupied rates have taken centre stage, but they're grafted onto a machinery that just doesn't really give any workable foundations. So in cases such as Macro, which was to do with what counts as occupation for the purpose of a six-week period, which resets the exemption from rates where for which are unoccupied, the court commented on the reversal of the usual roles, that the case law that had been built up to establish what was occupation was now being deployed to help create an exemption. And so what's happened there is that hugely value significant exemptions have been conferred in a ill thought through way, which doesn't really cross-reference to the existing body of case law, and that has been utilised, some might say exploited, but to put it neutrally, utilised by well-informed advisers. And then the machinery has the ability of the legislation to intervene and to create disregards, etc. But that has not happened so far. And the courts have looked at the framework and said, well, this is how it works. And if Parliament wants it to work differently, then it needs to intervene. And so far, there haven't been exemptions which arise on the face of the legislation. Piece of legislation that's of enormous practical significance is the Local Government Finance Act of 2012, because this authorises local rates retention. And so there's been a fundamental shift from the position that was established under the 1988 Act of basically taking the finances away from the local authority. And suddenly the billing authority has got a financial interest in the way in which rates are collected in their area. Unfortunately, much of the resources that had existed prior to the 1988 Act, where there were expertise locally, have been dismantled in local authority funding cuts. But so there is a patchy interest on the part of local authorities to try to make good gaps in their local authority finance by taking innovative approaches to what's put in the rating list in order to try to recover a greater amount of tax take to help them deliver their stretched services in their area. But this creates a massive jeopardy, because when you have disputes, then these can take years to resolve, and then there is potentially a very large gap in local authority finance turning on whether those issues are resolved in a local authority's favour. Moreover, the procedural arrangements aren't particularly well set up for three-party disputes in the local tribunal systems. And I think this really just leads me on to my sort of concluding observations based on this survey of 419 years of rating history, which is that although it's of enormous interest to see where all this has come from, if you were seeking to design a system that was fit for purpose for a substantial tax take from modern businesses, I don't think you would assemble a legislative scheme that resembled the one I've just been describing, because it has large gaps in the middle of it. Some of the concepts are inherently uncertain, require an understanding of case law going back, you know, a couple of hundred years at the very least in some cases, and an understanding of a complex system of legislation. And that seems to me to be a very long way away from a efficient, workable scheme. And moreover, as a tax of property, it's becoming increasingly under strain, because physical property resembles less and less the economic generators of value in a modern society. So all of these trends, uncertainty, some practical unworkability, and the mismatch of what is valued and taxed and where the real economic value is, has led to an increasing clamour in recent years for whole-scale business rate reform in a way that makes the system workable and fit for purpose. Now, that debate is raging on, certainly in the financial press and in professional communities and amongst businesses. Whether or not there will be sufficient parliamentary time and enough thinking to restructure the arrangements in a way that is fit for purpose, time will tell. But in the meantime, in order to give advice to clients and to help people navigate through this system, it remains of importance to understand how this has come to be assembled in the way that it has, where these tensions have come from, and where one might be able to find some helpful guidance on resolving issues. And my experience suggests that the history is of real value as a resource for understanding that and then being able to advise clients as to how to best pursue their interests and to try to anticipate how higher courts might look at things through the prism of at least an understanding of how we got to this position, even though we can all probably agree that it's not a terribly satisfactory, even though the position itself is unsatisfactory in terms of a fit for purpose modern system of taxation. Anyway, that brings me to the end of my first ever podcast. Thank you very much indeed for listening and for staying with me on this weird and wonderful journey through a history of non-domestic rates. Please, if you do have any comments, please do let me know. My email is dkolinsky, K-O-L-I-N-S-K-Y, at landmarkchambers.co.uk, or you can contact me through LinkedIn. Anyway, thank you very much indeed for listening, and goodbye.